content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the May 14th, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week looks like it's set at the Mar-a-Lago Resort. There is a statue of former President Donald Trump with his right fist raised in the air, and the pillar that the statue is on is titled The Big Lie. And around the statue are just a host of the Republican elephants bowing down to the statue. The headline is The GOP's Loyalty Test. Why are Republicans bowing to Trump's false claim the election was stolen? That story shows up on our controversy of the week, but we will start with the first main story. A new strategy as vaccination rates drop. What happened? President Biden shifted the nation's vaccination strategy to target holdouts this week as the pace of inoculations dropped amid flagging demand, leading experts to question whether the U.S. will ever reach herd immunity. Biden set a new goal of getting at least one dose into 70% of the adult population by July 4th. Currently, over 147 million Americans, or 56% of U.S. adults, have gotten at least one shot, and more than 106 million, 41%, are fully vaccinated. To meet the 70% goal, the government will shift its focus from mass vaccination sites to smaller settings such as pharmacies, doctor's offices, and mobile clinics, and spend hundreds of millions on outreach and education campaign. We're going to make it easier than ever to get vaccinated, said Biden. The government will also target 12 to 15-year-olds whom the FDA is expected to authorize to receive the Pfizer vaccine next week. The tactical shift comes as vaccination numbers are dropping sharply. Fewer than a million doses were administered Monday, down from a high of 4.6 million on April 11th. And some states had doses piling up. Infectious disease specialists said that because the new variants are more infectious, vaccinating 80% of the population may be necessary for true herd immunity and for COVID cases to essentially disappear. Nonetheless, the vaccine campaign has already produced sharp national drops in deaths, hospitalizations, and new infections. The daily average of new cases fell below 50,000 for the first time since October, while average daily deaths dropped below 700, down from a high of 3,431 in January. Los Angeles County, once a hotspot, reported two straight days with zero deaths. And New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut announced they will lift most restrictions by May 19th. The light at the end of the tunnel is actually growing brighter and brighter, Biden said. Get vaccinated. What the editorial said. It now looks like the magical moment when we hit herd immunity and COVID-19 vanishes may be out of reach, said the Los Angeles Times. With worrisome strains spreading and so many Americans unwilling to put aside their irrational fears of vaccination, we may have to live with a troublesome number of COVID cases for the foreseeable future. To lower that number, the country needs a sustained and consistent vaccination effort across every level of society, led by heads of state down to churches and community groups. Don't freak out over herd immunity, said the New York Post. It's a handy concept, but also a slippery one, and expert estimates of the percentage required are merely guesses. The goal is to move toward a near-zero transmission rate, and our progress continues by leaps and bounds. Vaccine resistance is declining as people see that the shots are safe and effective, and tens of millions of unvaccinated could have natural immunity from already having had COVID. What the columnist said. The same people who've defied mask orders are now refusing vaccines, said William Salatin in Slate.com. And these miscreants and freeloaders are keeping the rest of us from resuming normal life. Some of the holdouts believe the virus is no big deal, but others have made a different calculation. They don't need to get vaccinated because others will. How selfish. Herd immunity is a dimmer, not an on and off switch, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com, and its impact is already visible. About 70% of vulnerable seniors have been vaccinated and are no longer dying in large numbers. As millions of shots go into arms every week, the virus gets a little less room to maneuver. So far, the vaccines are even proving to be very effective against the variants. The big picture, in other words, is very encouraging. Every day we're moving incrementally closer to victory, said Juliet Cayen in TheAtlantic.com. Israel offers a hopeful example. With some 60% of Israelis receiving at least one dose, they're averaging fewer than 2 deaths and 90 new cases per day, a stunning drop from 8,000 daily cases in early January. The variants, vaccination culture wars, and spikes in India and Brazil still give us plenty of reasons to worry, but public health leaders should acknowledge what is now clear. In the U.S., we are winning the war against COVID-19. And the controversy of the week, as noted before, referencing our cover drawing, Republicans, why they're embracing the big lie. Who says the post-Trump Republican Party doesn't stand for anything, said Ashley Parker in the Washington Post. Top Republican officials have now fully committed themselves to Donald Trump's big lie that Democrats stole the 2020 election, making it a defining loyalty test. At the Utah State GOP convention last week, Senator Mitt Romney was greeted with a thunderous chorus of boos and cries of traitor and communist for voting to impeach Trump twice and acknowledging that Joe Biden won the election. In Arizona, the GOP-controlled state Senate is using a sketchy private company headed by a big lie proponent to perform an ongoing audit of November's ballots to manufacture evidence of mass fraud. In Washington, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy has reversed his original statement that Trump bears responsibility for the January 6th insurrection, now saying, in contradiction of all evidence, Trump didn't see it. This week, McCarthy was caught on a hot mic saying he's had it with Representative Liz Cheney after the GOP conference chair tweeted out the banal truth that the 2020 election was not stolen. Cheney's conviction is admirable, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com, but even as a hardcore traditional conservative, she has no chance of persuading the GOP to return to sanity. Republicans have clearly made a choice. Their loyalty lies with Trump. The GOP's radical turn isn't just about loyalty to Trump, said Jonathan Bernstein in Bloomberg.com. Fictional voter fraud was a Republican obsession long before 2020 because of the base's existential fear that white Christians are being outnumbered. So elected Republicans have decided that by believing or pretending to believe Trump's fantastical lies, they can ram through voter suppression laws and stay viable as a party of white rural grievance in an increasingly black, Hispanic, and urban America. Despite being unable to provide a shred of evidence that the 2020 election was stolen, Republicans are citing the lack of voter confidence as justification for all 361 election integrity bills Republicans have introduced in 47 states. This feverish nonsense won't help Republicans regain Congress in the White House, said Quinn Hillier and WashingtonExaminer.com. Why lie about the 2020 election when the GOP could be talking to voters about what the woke left wants to do in America, including packing the Supreme Court, eliminating fossil fuels, and providing free health care to illegal immigrants? Sadly, the Republican Party, to which I used to proudly belong, now caters to people who live in an alternative universe of false narratives, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. Only 11% of Republicans believe climate change poses a serious threat, and 46% think former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin did not commit a crime. The lie that Trump actually won the 2020 election, which polls show is embraced by two-thirds of Republicans, joins the larger foundation of falsehoods upon which the right-wing movement now rests. Down this road lies real danger, said Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. This country needs a sane, center-right party that offers viable alternatives to an increasingly liberal Democratic Party. But the Trumpian GOP is focused on how to win without doing that, by rigging the rules, suppressing voting, stoking cultural panic, and denying the validity of any election they lose. If Republicans succeed in enabling roughly 42% of the country to rule the rest, America will descend into a political civil war, and we're going to see exactly how a democracy dies. Here's our good week, bad week segment. It was a good week for UFOlogists after former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid told The New Yorker that he had heard for decades that aerospace giant Lockheed Martin was in possession of retrieved materials from crashed extraterrestrial spacecraft. Reid, 81, said he asked to examine the materials, but they would not approve that. It was a good week for Greater Belgium after a Belgian farmer moved a small rectangular stone, unaware that it had marked the border between France and Belgium since 1819. The stone's relocation has expanded Belgium by 7.5 feet into former French territory, so the local mayor wants it moved back to avoid a diplomatic incident. It was a good week for playing the odds with the news that a Chinese rocket would re-enter the atmosphere around May 8th and crash to Earth. Experts say the risk of to any particular individual is incredibly tiny. But it was a bad week for too much time at home after the American Society of Plastic Surgeons said there was a 22% increase in butt implants in 2020, perhaps because lots of sitting leads to a general flattening. It was a bad week for the last full measure of devotion after a man visiting the Gettysburg battlefield had to be rescued by firefighters when a falling tree trapped him in a porta potty. He was very lucky, said Assistant Fire Chief Joe Robinson. It was a large tree, and it just missed striking him. Finally, it was a bad week for commitment after St. Louis radio DJ Mason Schrader got a large tattoo of his station, 92.3 WIL, and was fired a week later. Schrader tweeted that the tattooed area is still healing. Ha, ha, ha. And a short news piece before we move on. U.S. will increase refugee limits. President Biden said this week that he was raising the refugee cap for the current fiscal year to 62,500, a figure that he said erases the record low of 15,000 previously set by the Trump administration. Biden had promised in his campaign to allow more refugees into the U.S., and assured Congress in February that he would do so. In April, however, facing a swell of asylum requests at the southwest border, Biden signed an order keeping the Trump limit, prompting fierce blowback from progressives and immigration advocates. Biden conceded that the U.S. would not reach the goal of 62,500 admissions, since 8 months of the fiscal year have already elapsed. He has promised to double the cap to 125,000 for the next fiscal year. Our briefing article this week is titled, Training Cops to De-escalate. Can police officers be taught to defuse confrontations instead of using deadly force? What is de-escalation? It's a method of policing designed to reduce shootings and other uses of force by teaching cops to act slowly, ask open-ended questions, and resist the urge to draw their guns. The average recruit receives less than 10 hours of de-escalation instruction, compared with 58 hours of firearms training, and 29 states don't require it. But de-escalation has become a top priority of police reform advocates who say it's crucial for reducing the 1,000 deaths at the hands of police each year, especially the roughly 40% involving citizens without guns. After police in Kenosha, Wisconsin shot Jacob Blake 7 times in the back last year, leaving him paralyzed, Governor Tony Evers called for officers to undergo annual de-escalation training. In recent weeks, police departments in New Haven, Connecticut, Providence, Rhode Island, and Tempe, Arizona, have introduced de-escalation programs. Cops have been taught that they always have to win, said Chuck Wexler, a consultant to police departments. Officers must learn to be guardians, he said, rather than warriors. What does training look like? Cops role play in high-stakes scenarios with actors and experienced officers playing unhinged or threatening suspects. Trainees also study footage from real-life encounters, identifying opportunities for de-escalation. In Baltimore, more than half of residents say they've witnessed police using excessive force. A new 16-hour de-escalation course teaches officers how to react to citizens wielding knives or attempting suicide by cop. Rather than drawing their guns and barking orders, officers are taught to patiently talk with suspects and try to establish a rapport, maintain distance, use cover for protection, summon help, and use a taser only if necessary. When I say back away, some police officers recoil, Wexler says. Police are taught you never give up. In some situations, it's okay to back off. Does it work? Though there are no national studies comparing departments, cities that employ de-escalation have seen promising results. Louisville saw a 28% drop in use of force incidents in 2019 and a 26% decline in citizen injuries at the hands of police. Use of force incidents fell 32% in Cleveland and 24% in San Francisco after officers completed de-escalation training. Police in Newark, New Jersey, didn't fire a single shot last year, which is the city's public safety director credited to a de-escalation program introduced in 2018. In Camden, New Jersey, once among the nation's most violent cities, the police department has overhauled its use of force policies over the past 7 years, and complaints of excessive force are down 95%. How can cops avoid firing shots? One way is to change the rules of engagement. More departments authorize officers to shoot suspects with knives if they come within 21 feet, and some 100 knife-wielding people are killed by police each year. There really is no scientific basis in that rule, said Rajiv Sethi, a Barnard College professor who studies police use of deadly force. When officers are forced to subdue a suspect, they have a range of options before drawing their firearms, including batons, beanbag guns, pepper spray, and tasers. Police are exploring new alternatives such as BOLA wrap, which allows officers to shoot Kevlar strings at 640 feet per second that wrap around suspects' arms or legs and immobilize them without causing serious injury. Why is de-escalation training controversial? It requires officers to abandon a warrior mindset that equates citizens with enemy soldiers and crime-heavy neighborhoods with battlefields. Police training often resembles military boot camp, and police officials commonly refer to officers as troops. The paramilitary approach was reinforced by a Defense Department program that sent surplus equipment, including grenade launchers and mine-resistant vehicles, to local law enforcement agencies. Geronimo Yanez, the Minneapolis cop who killed Philando Castile during a traffic stop in 2016, had previously attended a lethal force class called the Bulletproof Warrior. When the Los Angeles police chief announced a new award in 2015 for officers who resolved dangerous confrontations peacefully, the police union objected, saying the award valued the lives of suspects over officers. Do cops want the new training? Many still need to be persuaded that de-escalation won't endanger their lives. The opposite is generally true because police are safer when there are fewer violent confrontations. After Louisville instituted de-escalation training, officer injuries dropped 36%. I was trained to fight the war on crime, said former Seattle Police Chief Kathleen O'Toole. We were measured by the number of arrests. Over time, I realized policing went well beyond that. A model case of de-escalation played out in April when San Francisco police responded to an auto burglary and found a black suspect, Marcel King, sitting in a van with a machete in hand. Rather than rushing him with guns drawn, a crisis negotiation team spent 3 hours talking King into exiting the van without his machete and surrendering. By de-escalating the situation, we got a peaceful resolution, Lieutenant Michael Nevin said. No news incidents are the great news incidents. Time to read a few of the columns. We'll start with two from the U.S. The first titled, It's Time to Fully Reopen Schools. For all the talk about following the science, said Veronique DeRugi, it's hard to believe that some school districts aren't fully open yet and won't even commit to full-time instruction in the fall. We have lots of evidence that opening schools has no impact on community transmission of the coronavirus, and that remote learning and hybrid school schedules have been a disaster for most kids and for mothers who want or need to work. Minority kids have particularly suffered. By now, nearly all teachers have had access to vaccination, and soon, kids as young as 12 will also be able to get shots. Yes, kids can get COVID, but their symptoms are usually mild. Some teachers' unions and parents are essentially arguing that schools shouldn't open until the virus is completely eradicated, but there is no such thing as a zero-risk society. Just putting kids in cars carries some risk. The Biden administration has funneled billions of dollars to schools so they can safely operate in the COVID era, and it's past time schools and teachers got back to full-time education. History will not look kindly on those who kept schools closed longer than necessary. Giuliani could turn on Trump. Rudy Giuliani appears to be in big trouble, said former federal prosecutor Renato Mariotti, which should make his client, former President Donald Trump, very nervous. Federal investigators raided Giuliani's Manhattan apartment and office last week, seizing computers and cell phones as they probed Giuliani's Ukraine dealings, which were at the heart of Trump's first impeachment. To get a warrant from a federal judge, prosecutors need to show strong evidence that a crime has been committed, indicating that the criminal investigation against Giuliani is far along. Prosecutors probably already can show that Giuliani was acting in behalf of a Kremlin-backed Ukrainian oligarchs and officials when he persuaded Trump to fire the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. If he was, Giuliani would have been required by law to register as a foreign lobbyist. Giuliani's defense will likely be that he was acting completely at Trump's direction. But will Trump testify on his lawyer's behalf? Not likely, considering Trump is not known for sticking his neck out for disgraced former aides. Just ask Michael Cohen. If it's the only way to save himself from dying in prison, the 76-year-old Giuliani will have every incentive to spill damning secrets about Trump. This column comes from Australia. Be afraid, the mice are coming. New South Wales has turned into a real-life horror movie, said Lachlan Leeming. A sudden boom in the field mouse population has sent millions of the rodents marauding across the state, eating everything in their path. This is a state that has already endured 3 years of drought, followed by wildfires and then floods. Farmers were counting on this year's harvest, and now the mice have stripped their fields bare. The mind boggles at what the little bastards can do, said farmer Greg Storer, who watched an undulating carpet of field mice gobble up 800 acres of wheat. Those crops haven't satisfied the rodents' hunger. They have also eaten through walls, infested schools, and are nibbling people in their beds and in their homes and cars. The smell is everywhere, both the stink of their urine when they are alive and the stench of their rotting bodies when they die. Disgusted, exhausted residents are looking ahead to winter's arrival in June, hoping that the cold will break the cycle. But since mice mature at 6 weeks and can have litters of pups every 3 weeks, it will take a particularly vicious winter to break this plague. And that would be yet another natural catastrophe. The last word, our feature article this week, is titled, Where the Bodies Burn. India's ruling party said it had defeated COVID, said Aman Sethi in the New York Times. Now, just 2 months later, deaths are piling up faster than COVID victims can be put to rest. The first 36 corpses were placed in the designated concrete cremation pits and set ablaze by 10 in the morning. After that, all the extra bodies went to the muddy parking lot for a mass ceremony later. Last week, ambulances doubling up as hearses lined up along the narrow streets outside the Ghazipur crematory on the city's eastern border. There were no cremation pits in the parking lot, so hospital attendants in protective equipment carried out the dead and placed them near the scorch marks left behind by the previous day's pyres. Ram Karan Mishra, the presiding priest of the parking lot, walked among the corpses unmasked and unafraid. If I fall sick and die, I will go to heaven, he said, before paraphrasing a popular reading of Hindu scripture. Death is the only truth. It is an aphorism that India's government would do well to remember. 2 months ago, India's ruling party claimed that India had defeated COVID under the able, sensible, committed, and visionary leadership of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. In January, Modi told the World Economic Forum in Davos that India has saved humanity from a big disaster by containing corona effectively. Today, as a deadly second wave of coronavirus ravages the country with some 300,000 new infections daily and more than 21,400 dead over the past week, Modi and his party are downplaying the severity of the crisis, grossly underestimating the numbers of sick and the dead. Tushar Mehta, one of the government's lead lawyers, recently claimed that nobody in the country was left without oxygen. Yet crippling shortages of oxygen and hospital beds have resulted in many deaths, including of a former ambassador who passed away in his car while waiting for care for hours outside a fancy private clinic. The chief minister of Uttar Pradesh, India's most populous state and one of its poorest, has asked officials to seize the property of people he accuses of spreading rumors about shortages on social media. The Indian government has ordered Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to take down dozens of posts criticizing its handling of the pandemic. But the graphic images of mass cremations have cut through this wall of noise, misinformation, and propaganda, capturing what epidemiologists call excess mortality in gruesome detail. Everyone I know has lost someone to the virus. Most have lost several members of their family. But while you're in lockdown, the dead don't feel dead as much as disappeared. So when my father called me on Tuesday to say that his uncle had died of COVID-19, that the uncle's whole family was ill with the disease, and that a cousin of my father's was in an intensive care unit, I sensed the onset of a familiar numbness. "I might go out for a drive," I mumbled vaguely to my wife over dinner that night. But as I got into my car the next morning and drove out to several crematories, I realized I just wanted to feel something. The parking lot at Ghazipur is so small and the bodies are so closely packed that the pyres can be lit only all at once. So the corpses are placed on individual pyres through the day and then ignited in one big blaze in the evening. Mishra, the priest, told me last week that for the past 10 days, the crematory staff has been burning between 40 and 50 bodies every day in a space no larger than two tennis courts. The heat from the flames has scorched the leaves of the mango trees facing the pyres to a deep, sooty black, while the tops of the canopies still shone a bright summer green. A cremation site is a mostly male space. Many Hindus still believe that only a son has the right to light his parents' funeral pyre. At Ghazipur, small groups of young men briefly put their grief on hold to divide themselves into teams and tend various tasks. One group runs off to stand in the queue to register the corpse of their loved one. Another dashes to the shed to get their allotted share of the wood before all the good pieces run out. A third rushes with the body to reserve a spot on which to build a pyre. Everything in this pandemic, medicines, oxygen, ventilators, hospital beds, has been marked by scarcity born of the government's total failure to plan for and procure essential supplies. The crematory is no different. Last week, Pavika Parakh, one of the few women at Ghazipur, stood alone amid this frenzy. The body of her father, Dr. Dattaraj Blattardandra Parakh, at her feet. He was a plant pathologist at India's National Bureau of Plant Genetic Resources and was 65 years old when he died of COVID-19. He needed an ICU bed with a ventilator, but Mrs. Parakh could organize only a hospital bed with an oxygen cylinder. His oxygen stats didn't come up, she said. He had died at 7:30 that morning. Mrs. Parakh's mother died a decade ago. Most of her other relatives had COVID-19. A family member who had escorted her father's body from the hospital to morgue to the crematory had suddenly felt sick there. So here she was alone, a 32-year-old clinical psychologist standing by her father's corpse in a parking lot turned crematory, trying to make sense of it all. It's like one of those movies in which the world has been attacked and there are bodies everywhere, she said, as she looked at the rows and rows and rows and rows of pyres in various stages of completion. You wait for the superhero to come and save everyone. Only in this case, there is no superhero. Earlier that week, Bicky, a young mortuary assistant at a private hospital in the city, had told me about a new type of funeral, the WhatsApp funeral. He wouldn't give his full name because he isn't supposed to talk to journalists. When COVID-19 patients in the ICU breathe their last breath, Bicky wheels the bodies down to the morgue. There, he carefully wraps each corpse in a mortuary sheet, then in a plastic sheet, then in the distinctive white tarp that marks this death as a COVID-19 case. He secures everything with white micropore surgical tape. When a family member comes, we quickly unwrap the head so they can peek at the face and identify the body, Bicky said. Often, an immediate family member is either stranded abroad or isolated with COVID, so we put on a WhatsApp video call and show them the face. Then Bicky and his team place the body in an ambulance and accompany it to the crematory. I met Bicky and his colleagues at the crematory at Sarai Kail Khan, also in the city's east, before heading to Ghazipur. As we spoke, construction workers used cement and red brick to quickly build human-sized platforms just outside the crematory's walls. They can only do 10 bodies at a time inside the crematory, Bicky said. They are building space for another 50. I counted 30 bodies in front of me. There were 20 more at the back, Bicky said. One of Bicky's attendants said that every night for the past week he had dreamed of the faces of the dead passing before his eyes in an endless parade. I'm pulling back the tarp and I'm seeing their faces, he said. I've forgotten their names, but I'm seeing their faces. A month ago, I was called to the apartment on the floor just below mine. My neighbor, a retired Air Force officer in his 70s, had been in bed for a week with a high fever, but had tested negative for the coronavirus. Now Uncle, as I call him, had lost consciousness. We tried to revive him using a portable oxygen cylinder he had at his bedside. His elderly brother pointed his cell phone camera at the cylinder while someone on the other end of a WhatsApp call tried to tell us how to use it. Auntie, Uncle's wife, was in shock. Hello, she said, taking Uncle's hand in hers. Hello? Say something. Slowly and inexorably, and then all at once, Uncle's oxygen level fell to zero. The ambulance arrived soon after. He was declared dead at the hospital and also COVID positive. His children flew in from abroad, but they couldn't meet their mother for 2 weeks. She, too, had tested positive and had to isolate herself. I attended a prayer meeting in his memory over Zoom. After a week, I tried to get a COVID test, but couldn't because the labs were overwhelmed with samples. I isolated myself for 1 week, then another, no symptoms. My doctor suggested I continue my self-quarantine and watch out for symptoms rather than burden the city's already stretched testing infrastructure. Uncle's face appears in front of me each time I pass his door. Sometimes I'm reminded of his wife holding his hand as he was dying. Hello, Auntie says to him in my recollection. Hello? It was now a little after 3 p.m. at Ghazipur, and most of the pyres had been built. Wood is strictly rationed, so mourners began by fashioning what looked like a makeshift stretcher. First, three short, heavy logs were laid on the ground parallel to one another. Then longer, narrower planks were put on top, perpendicular to the logs. Once the body is placed on that stretcher, mourners arrange sticks upright around it in sort of a wooden tent and stuff that with bales of dry straw. The whole process took about 20 minutes. From then until the evening, mourners would flit back and forth like birds building a nest. They would pick up stray bits of straw, a length of broken bamboo, a gnarled knot of wood that someone had discarded, and fit them into the gaps in the pyre. A few pyres, including the one for Ms. Parak's father, were yet to be assembled. Ms. Parak was on her phone with her relatives trying to find someone who could help. A caretaker of the families was on his way, she said. He's been with us for over 20 years. So the loss is as much his as ours. Things moved faster once Ms. Parak's family caretaker arrived. Soon the pyre was built. It was almost 5 in the evening now, and the parking lot looked like a small, congested village of low, pointy-roofed homes. Mishra, the priest, made his way through the pyres, chanting hymns for the dead. A young woman sat weeping into the elbow of her protective suit. My parents are waiting outside, she told me, pointing to one wooden structure among the others. It's my husband. My husband, that's my husband. The first pyre was lit, then another and another. Slowly the sound of chants and prayers was silenced by the crackling of flames burning through dry wood. The heat rose in gusts, then in waves, and then in a steady, shimmering wall. The fire's blazing. I thought of everyone my family and friends had lost over the past year. All the funerals we could not attend. All the grief this city carries. Ms. Parak stood before her father's pyre, talking into what looked like a WhatsApp group call on her phone. Nearby, a middle-aged man in a striped T-shirt told me, pointing at a pyramid of flames, "That's my mother." Non-COVID case. It is a pity that she had to be cremated in the middle of all this. He had another complaint. Don't mind, but the media is making it seem like bodies are being burned everywhere all the time to show the government in a bad light. Are we not in a parking lot among 50 burning pyres? I asked him. Yes, he replied. But the media should say these pyres are lit all at once, only once a day, so people get the correct impression. Death is the only truth, I said. Death is the only truth, he said. The blaze continued for several hours. Small groups of mourners began to leave, their eyes glistening with tears, held back through the fear, the frustration, the heartbreak, the exhaustion, the heat, the horror, and the sorrow. Ms. Parak and her caretaker walked out, hailed down an auto rickshaw, and went home to the house she had once shared with her father. Remember to come by 8 tomorrow morning to collect the ashes, Mishra told everyone. We need to clear up in preparation for tomorrow's cremations. A version of this story was originally published in the New York Times. Read one of the obituaries this week. The Apollo 11 pilot who was all alone in space. Michael Collins, 1930 to 2021. For 3.5 hours on July 20th, 1969, Michael Collins was the loneliest man in the universe. As pilot of the Apollo 11 spacecraft Columbia, Collins orbited the moon at 3,700 miles per hour, while astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin made their historic first steps 60 miles below. "You cats take it easy," Collins radioed his crewmates as they descended to the lunar surface. Despite his cheerful words, Collins feared Armstrong and Aldrin might never make it back to the Columbia, and he ran repeatedly through the 117-page list of contingencies he'd drawn up in case of disaster. "If they fail to rise from the surface or crash back into it, I am not going to commit suicide," he recalled thinking. "I am coming home forthwith, but I will be a marked man for life." His worries never came to pass. The three astronauts splashed into the Pacific on July 4th, 1969, and emerged from their craft as national heroes. Collins was born in Rome, where his father, a major general in the army, was the military attaché to the U.S. Embassy, said the New York Times. After graduating from West Point, Collins joined the Air Force to avoid suggestions of nepotism in future assignments. He became a fighter test pilot, said the Guardian, and in 1956 bailed out of a flaming F-86. The experience boosted his confidence about handling sticky situations. Applying to NASA after John Glenn's historic solo orbit of Earth in 1962, Collins blasted off for the first time on Gemini 10 in 1966. He became the first astronaut to emerge twice from a spacecraft during the same mission, once to snap photos from an open hatch, and later for a spacewalk to retrieve a scientific device from a floating Gemini 8 rocket. A slipped disc in 1968 nearly derailed his astronaut career, said the Washington Post, but he recovered in time to be tapped for Apollo 11. Content with his status as the mission's third man, Collins retired from NASA in 1970 and went to work at the State Department and then as founding director of the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. The author of several books, he described the wonders of space flight with a poet's touch. I have seen the sun's true light, unfiltered by any planet's atmosphere. I have seen the ultimate black of infinity in a stillness undisturbed by any living thing, he wrote in a 1974 memoir. I do have this secret, this precious thing that I will always carry with me. We'll go ahead and pick up a couple of articles on the health and science page. Human-monkey hybrids. For the first time, researchers have produced monkey embryos that contain human stem cells, a major scientific breakthrough that also raises significant ethical questions. Scientists have been creating partly human chimeras in labs for years by injecting human stem cells into rats, mice, pigs, and cows. The resulting combinations, they hope, could be used to grow human organs for transplant, to examine illness and aging, and to develop new drugs. The human macaque chimeras, a collaboration between the Salk Institute in California and scientists in China, were kept alive and studied for only 19 days, reports the Wall Street Journal. But the use of humanity's closest animal relatives in such experiments has bioethicists worried about unintended outcomes. When researchers in 2014 transplanted human fetal brain cells into mice, the human cells took over the mouse brains within a year, and cognitive tests showed that the altered mice were smarter than their peers. Insoo Hyun, a bioethicist involved in the oversight of such research, says the big concern is that stem cell chimeras have the potential to radically humanize the biology of laboratory animals. Sore muscles? Don't use ice. Ice packs are a go-to for people who feel achy after a vigorous workout or sports injury. But there is mounting evidence that icing actually hampers the healing process, reports the New York Times. Several recent studies have suggested as much. One in 2011 found that people who iced a torn calf muscle endured the same pain and recovery time as those who left their leg alone. The latest study looked at the problem at a microscopic level in mice. Researchers electrically stimulated the legs of 40 mice to simulate a muscle-tearing session at the gym. Then they strapped tiny ice packs to the legs of half the mice, left the others unchilled, and collected regular muscle samples over the next 2 weeks. In the ice-free mice, pro-inflammatory cells spent a couple of days clearing away the damaged tissue, and then anti-inflammatory cells helped rebuild the muscle. But in the iced mice, it took 7 days for the pro-inflammatory cells to do their work, and the muscle still showed signs of damage after 2 weeks. The data, said lead author Takamitsu Arakawa from Japan's Kobe University, suggests that icing retards healthy inflammatory responses. We are on the Talking Points page. We'll start with an article titled, Racism, Scott's Rebuttal to the Left. Tim Scott just offered America an optimistic Republican vision to combat President Joe Biden's big government zeal, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. In his rebuttal to Biden's address to Congress last week, the Senate's only black Republican lauded the freedom and opportunities that allowed him and so many others to succeed, and then delivered this electrifying moment. Hear me clearly, he said. America is not a racist country. Liberals reacted with contrived hyperbolic outrage, said David Harsanyi at nationalreview.com. Since Scott acknowledged he'd experienced bigotry himself and had been pulled over by police at least 18 times, the left insisted he had contradicted himself and smeared him as Uncle Tim. But Scott is right. The lingering existence of some racism doesn't mean the nation itself is fundamentally, legally, culturally, or systemically racist. Scott wasn't chosen to rebut Biden's speech, said Clay Kane in CNN.com. Party leaders picked him to play the role of the black man who makes white Americans more comfortable. Scott, who voted with Donald Trump 90% of the time, performed that role with aplomb, quoting scripture and citing his family's Cotton to Congress narrative to insist that America had overcome the sins of its past. Certainly, America is not the same country it was, said Charles Blow in the New York Times, but neither is it the country it purports to be. Even today, America's institutions produce measurably poorer outcomes for black people because of built-in biases. Just 6 months ago, nearly half the country voted for a full-on racist in Donald Trump. Based on the evidence, saying that America is racist is not a radical statement. Republicans and Democrats define racism differently, said Philip Bump in the Washington Post. Republicans prefer to see racism as an outlier, a function of explicit racists who openly say blacks are inferior. Democrats focus on the structural or systemic racism that produces these results. Black families have on average 1/10 of the wealth of their white counterparts, are rejected at an 80% higher rate for mortgages, attend more dysfunctional schools, lead shorter lives, and are more likely to be stopped or killed by police. It's obvious that our political and economic institutions aren't working equally for everyone. That's the real issue, not the straw man question of whether America itself is racist. Smoking. Should menthols be banned? The Food and Drug Administration has taken its single most important step to reduce the deadly impact of smoking, said the Los Angeles Times in an editorial. Last week, the agency said it will move to ban menthol cigarettes, a measure long pursued by anti-smoking advocates. When Congress banned flavored cigarettes in 2009, menthols got a carve-out, but it's past time to do away with the insidious products whose minty flavors mask the abrasiveness of tobacco smoke, lead people to inhale more deeply, and make it easier for people to start smoking and harder for them to quit. Since 85% of black smokers favor menthols, a ban would also have a significant racial justice implications. My childhood neighborhood was filled with billboards for menthol cigarettes, which big tobacco has used to hook black children, said pediatrician Nia Hurd Garris in USA Today. Eliminating these deadly products now is a way to affirm that indeed black lives matter. A menthol prohibition could have severe negative consequences for those it aims to protect, said Eli Lehrer in NationalReview.com. Banning this type of cigarette, research indicates, will produce only a modest decline in smoking, but it almost certainly will lead to a boom in bootleg sales of menthols from Mexico in black communities that already suffer from over-policing, leading to more fines, arrests, and confrontations with cops. That's why the ACLU and other social justice groups oppose a menthol ban. In the inevitable black market that a ban would create, small-time sellers would predominate, said Jacob Greer in Reason.com. They'd be people like Eric Garner of Staten Island, New York, who was choked to death by police during an arrest for selling loose cigarettes. The irony is that as liberal scolds continue their war on smoking, the cannabis business booms, said Matthew Walter in TheAmericanConservative.com. Now quasi-legal in 33 states, marijuana pulls in some $17.5 billion annually, and while tobacco marketing has been reduced to manufacturers' coupons sent discreetly by mail, like Victorian pornography, billboards for marijuana dispensaries line the highways of my home state of Michigan. By the time my children are old enough to smoke, they'll have to walk past bustling weed outlets and furtively seek out a man in a Hawaiian shirt in the back of a shady apartment complex in the hope of a nicotine fix. Looks like we've got time for a couple of short notes. The number of centenarians people in their hundreds is soaring worldwide as lifespans continue to grow. In 1990, there were about 95,000 centenarians, but by 2015, there were 450,000, according to the United Nations estimates. By 2100, the UN projects there will be 25 million. At least 400 people from 43 states have been charged for taking part in the January 6th Capitol insurrection, with new defendants indicted daily. Prosecutors say they expect to charge at least 500 people who took part in the assault, which injured more than 100 Capitol police officers, some seriously, and forced Senate and House members into hiding. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from Voltaire, quoted in the Nashville Tennessean, who says, "Doubt is not a pleasant condition, but certainty is absurd." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.